My paternal grandparents were farmers. My dad was a bus driver. My mother worked in a shelter for victims of domestic violence. My sister is a nurse. My brother orders stock for a supermarket. All of these jobs are necessary. If they stop being done, then key parts of our society would cease to function. And if that work, being bossed around, being made to do it, being disciplined by the market into doing stuff that's tedious but necessary, is essential, then even if it causes depression and anxiety, it must continue. It felt like a necessary trap. On an individual level, a few of us might escape. If you can move to a job where you're controlled less and have more autonomy, or are doing something you believe matters, do it. Your anxiety and depression levels will likely dip. But in a landscape where only 13% of people have jobs they find meaningful, that advice seems almost cruel. Most of us aren't, in this environment as it stands today, going to get to work that we find personally meaningful. As I say this, I'm picturing one person I know and love who's a single mum working a low-paid job she hates in order to keep her three kids in their apartment. Telling her she needs a more fulfilling job when she's battling to keep a job at all would be both mean and meaningless. I began to think about this obstacle differently and to see a way beyond it, only when I went to a rather prosaic place. It's a small store in Baltimore that sells and repairs bikes. They told me a story, and that story opened me up to a much wider debate and to the evidence that suggests we can infuse our work with greater meaning and make it radically less depressing, not just for a few privileged individuals, but for the whole society. The day that Meredith Mitchell handed in her resignation, she wondered if she was doing something crazy. She worked at the fundraising arm of a not-for-profit campaign group in Maryland. It was a typical office job. She was given assignments with a deadline, and her role was to keep her head down and do what she was told. Sometimes she would have ideas about how they could do things better. If she tried to put them forward, she was told to get on with what she'd been assigned. She had a boss who seemed like a nice person, but she was volatile and Meredith never really knew how to read her moods. Meredith knew that in the abstract her work was probably doing some good, but she never felt any connection to it. It felt like a karaoke life. Her job was to sing along to a song sheet written by somebody else. It wasn't a life where she would ever get to write her own song. At the age of 24, she could see this stretching out before her for the next 40 years. Around this time, Meredith started to feel a pervasive sense of anxiety she couldn't quite understand. On Sunday nights, she'd feel her heart pounding in her chest and a sense of dread about the week to come. Before long, she found she couldn't sleep during the week either. She kept waking up feeling cripplingly nervous, but she didn't know why. Yet when she told her boss she was quitting, she wasn't at all sure she was doing the right thing. She'd grown up in a politically conservative family, and what she was about to embark on seemed radical and strange to them, and if she was honest to herself. Meredith's husband, Josh, had a plan. He'd started working in bike stores when he was 16 years old. And he'd been riding bikes as a hobby for years before that. He loved the 20-inch trick bikes on which you could whir around the city and carry out stunts off the sides of sloped buildings. But working in bike stores, he learned, is a really hard way to make a living. It's low-wage work. You don't get a job contract or sick pay or vacations. It can be monotonous at times, and you're pervasively insecure. You can't plan for anything and there's no path up. You're basically stuck on the bottom rung. If you ever wanted a raise or a day off or to stay home when you were ill, you had to beg the boss. Josh had been working for a few years in a typical bike store in the city. The owner wasn't, on a personal level, a bad guy, but life working in his bike store was, for all these reasons, pretty miserable. You could bear it as a teenager, but as you got into your 20s and started to think about the future, you found there was just a big hole ahead of you. At first, Josh's solution was to try something has largely faded from life in the United States. He approached his colleagues, there were 10 people working in the store, and asked them if they would consider, together, setting up a labor union to formally demand better conditions. It took some time to persuade people, but Josh is an enthusiastic guy, and everyone who worked there agreed to sign on. They drew up a list of pretty basic demands that they felt would make their lives better. They wanted written contracts. They wanted pay rises for two of the workers to bring them up to the level of everyone else. and they wanted annual meetings to discuss salaries. It wasn't much, but it would, they felt, make them feel less anxious and more secure. But the list of demands was, in truth, more than that. It was a way of saying, we're not just cogs in a machine like the screws we put into the bikes when we fix them. We're people with needs. We're partners and we deserve respect. He didn't think of it this way then, but it was about restoring dignity, Josh told me later, to working class people who were being told they were basically not worth much and could be tossed aside at any time. Josh felt they were in a strong position, though, because he knew the business couldn't function without them. When he was presented with the demands, Josh's boss looked really surprised, but he said he'd think about it. A few days later, he employed a tough labour-busting lawyer, and a long process of trying to deny them the right to organise began. It dragged on for months, and the whole US legal system is designed to make it hard to organise a union and easy to break one up. The workers couldn't afford any kind of lawyer. His boss started to bring in new workers to undermine the unionised ones. Josh knew that technically it'd be illegal for his boss to fire him or the other workers, but both sides knew the workers couldn't afford a long legal fight to assert that right. That is when Josh had an idea. He knew how bike stores were run. The workers knew how it operated because they literally did almost all the work. He thought, we could do this. We could run a store like this ourselves, without the boss. If this was a conventional American story, Josh would now break away and set up his own business and rise to become the Jeff Bezos of bikes, or at least end up owning his own beach house on the Jersey Shore. But Josh didn't want to become the guy who orders everyone else around. In his years working in bike shops, he'd noticed some things. The boss is isolated. Even when he's a nice guy, he's pushed into this weird position, controlling other people, that makes it hard for him to connect in ordinary ways. And this system of having one guy at the top giving orders seemed to Josh to be quite inefficient. The guys working on the shop floor had loads of good ideas about how to make the business better. They could see things the boss couldn't see, but it made no difference. Their thoughts were irrelevant. And that actually harmed, Josh suspected, the business itself. No, what Josh wanted was to be part of a business that ran on a different American ideal. Democracy. He read up on the history of something called cooperatives. It turns out the way of working that we all take for granted now, a corporation that's run like an army, with one person at the top giving orders to the troops below who have no say, is actually quite recent. It was only in the late 19th century that it became standard for human beings to work this way. When the boss-run corporation first started to take over, it was resisted intensely. Lots of people pointed out that it would create a system of what they called wage slavery, in which people would be controlled all the time and would end up feeling miserable. Some of them, Josh learned, had proposed organising our work on totally different principles. They were called democratic cooperatives, and Josh learned that some had been really successful. So Josh talked with some of his close friends, people he'd worked alongside for a long time, and with his wife Meredith about an idea. Let's run our own bike store and do it as a cooperative. That means we'll share the work and we'll share the profits. We'll make the decisions democratically. We won't have a boss because we'll all be the boss. We're going to work hard, but we'll work differently. And it might just make us feel better. Meredith thought it sounded appealing, but as she quit her old job, she kept wondering, was it realistic? How would it work? As I approached Baltimore Bicycle Works on its corner in the downtown of the city, it looked like any other bike store. On the ground floor, there are bright bikes and accessories all around on a cement floor, and there's a cash register where Meredith was working when I arrived. When she took me upstairs, I saw there was a row of bikes lifted up as if on pulleys, and guys standing next to them looking as if they were performing some kind of primitive surgery. The bikes were partly dismantled, and they were being altered with screwdrivers and some tool I'd never seen before. Images of George Clooney repairing somebody's heart on ER flickered through my mind. Alex Teachew, a guy in his late 20s with a big bushy moustache, carried on working on the bike as he told me about his life before he became a partner here, when he worked for a catering firm. He would hear from his boss once every 2 weeks, and he said it would be a phone call in the morning of her either yelling at me or expressing disappointment, and then a phone call at the end of the night, either yelling or expressing disappointment. But she had no idea what I was doing, so I never understood how she knew to be disappointed in me. Like a lot of people in standard jobs, he says, I would wake up stressed in the middle of the night. It was pretty bad. It was affecting everything. Here, he says, it works differently. At Baltimore Bicycle Works, they have a meeting every Thursday morning to discuss together the decisions they have to make as a business. They divided the work of the business into 7 different chunks, from marketing to servicing broken bikes, and everyone takes joint responsibility for at least 2 of them. If anyone has an idea for how to do something better, or to stop doing something that's failing, they can propose it at that meeting. If somebody seconds it, they discuss it as a group, and then they vote on it. So, for example, if someone wants to start carrying a new brand of bicycles, that's the process they go through. There are 6 full-time partners in the business who all share the proceeds. And when I was there, there were also 3 apprentices who were spending a year as part of the process, and if everyone felt they were a good fit, would then become full partners. At the end of each year, everyone does an annual review on everyone else. The goal is for everyone to feel equally committed to the cooperative and able to find a way to make the best contribution they possibly can to it. It was a tough job to set up a new business, and Meredith explained to me that she was working 10 hours a day every day for the first year. She had more responsibility in this job than she'd had in her old one. But Meredith noticed something surprising. After she'd been there a short time, that heart-thumping, wake-in-the-night anxiety went away and it's never come back. I asked her why. She has some ideas, and they fit closely with what I'd learned about the science of depression and anxiety earlier. Every previous job she had was, she said, an out-of-control experience. There, it didn't matter if you had a good idea. If it was outside of your job scope, nobody was really interested in it. You got into your position and you did that job, you waited in line, and you would get promoted maybe after 5 years, and you did the next job for like 5 more years. But here, she says, her ideas and everyone's ideas count. I feel like it's different because if I have a good idea and want to explore something further, I feel like I have the liberty and the freedom to do that and to see these ideas come to fruition. When she suggests a different publicity strategy or figures out a mistake they've been making in fixing one particular kind of bike or thinks of a whole new item to stock, it can happen and she can see the results. As I sat with Meredith and watched the bike repairs happening all around us, I remembered what I'd learned from Michael Marmot, the social scientist who carried out the research into British civil servants that showed the ways in which our work can make us sick physically or mentally. He had explained to me, it's not the work itself that makes you sick. It's 3 other things. It's the feeling of being controlled, of being a meaningless cog in a system. It's the feeling that no matter how hard you work, you'll be treated just the same and nobody will notice, an imbalance, as he puts it, between efforts and rewards. And it's the feeling of being low on the hierarchy, of being a low status person who doesn't matter compared to the big man in the corner office. Everyone at Baltimore Bicycle Works said they were dramatically happier, less anxious and less depressed than they had been working in the kind of top-down organisations that dominate our society. But here's the thing that most fascinated me and showed me a way beyond the obstacle I thought was insurmountable. The actual day-to-day work for most of the people here hasn't changed radically. The guys who fix bikes before, fix bikes now. The guys who did publicity before, do publicity now. But changing the structure radically changed how they felt about the work itself. Josh, when I interviewed him on another day, told me why he thinks that is. I can certainly see depression and anxiety being related to the fact that people feel really, really confused and helpless, he said. I think it's hard for people to live in a society where you have no control over anything. You don't control your economic life from the standpoint that it's precarious whether you've got work at all. And then if you do have a job, you walk into the place, spend 40, 50, 60, 80 hours a week in this place. You don't have free speech. You don't have any sort of voting. Anxiety and depression seem to him, he said, rational reactions to the situation, as opposed to some kind of biological break. This way of living and working is, he explains, an attempt to deal with that problem. When you have no say over your work, it becomes dead and meaningless. When you control it, you can begin to infuse it with meaning. It becomes yours. And then if there's something about the work that depresses you, you can argue for it to be broken up or alternated with something more meaningful, and you have a good chance of being listened to. This might sound like a pretentious way to describe a bike shop, but it seemed to me that they had found a way of working that more closely resembled the participative tribes that human beings evolved to live in on the savannas of Africa millennia ago, one in which everyone is needed and everyone has a role that is meaningful to them. It also has a lot of advantages early humans didn't have. No large animals are going to come into Baltimore Bicycle Works and eat them, and they're going to live well beyond their 30s. This way of working provides, it occurred to me, several forms of reconnection at the same time. You are reconnected to your work because you feel you're choosing it, you can see the difference it makes, and you directly benefit from the work you do. You're reconnected to a sense of status. You aren't humiliated by having anyone order you around or tell you what to do. And you're reconnected to the future. Instead of knowing you could be fired at any moment, you know where you'll be a year or 5 years from now if you choose it and keep working hard. Of course, they all told me they still have bad days. They have days when they have to prod each other to do something. They have days when they don't feel like being at work. There are aspects of the job that feel like a chore. One of the original partners explained that it felt like too much responsibility to be partly in charge of the whole business and went back to a more conventional office job. This isn't a magical solution. But Meredith says, when I started working here, I didn't have trouble sleeping anymore. And she's echoed by several of her colleagues. They also feel it's more efficient, that they literally have a better bike shop. In the old system, you have one person's brain on every problem, and he might listen to the others if they're lucky. Here, you have nine people's brains on every problem. At bars and parties, when Meredith tells people about this work, they're often incredulous. She says, people are constantly amazed. They don't understand how you could possibly run a business like this. But she tells them, everyone's been in a group environment. Everyone's been in a family or on a team. You know how it works. She says, but all of a sudden, when you think about it in the context of making money or running a business, everyone's head explodes about it. But I don't feel like it's that complicated. People want it to be a lot more complicated than it actually is. They can't even imagine how people would work together to make simple decisions. I like to explain that it's a democratic organization. This isn't a foreign concept. You live in America. We say we're a democracy, but people are so far removed from the concept. Our politicians are constantly singing hymns to democracy as the best system, but this is simply the extension of democracy to the place where we spend most of our time. Josh says it's an amazing victory for their propaganda system to make you work in an environment you often can't stand and to do it for most of your waking life and see the proceeds of your labour get siphoned off by somebody at the top and then to make you think of yourself as a free person. Those people at parties tell Meredith that without a boss, everyone would surely just sit around doing nothing. But she explains, the business is our livelihood, so if we all just sat around and did nothing, then it would be nothing and we would get nothing out of it. But she thinks it goes deeper than that. From this experience, she's learned that, as she puts it, people want to work. Everybody wants to work. Everyone wants to feel useful and have purpose. The humiliation and control of so many workplaces can suppress that or drive it out of people. But it's always there and it re-emerges in the right environment. People want to feel like they've had an impact on other humans, she says, that they've improved the world in some way. In fact, there's good evidence that this increases effectiveness in the long term. A major study by scientists at Cornell University investigated 320 small businesses. Half had top-down control and half let the workers set their own agenda in a model that was closer to the democratic system at Baltimore Bicycle Works. The businesses closer to the democratic model grew on average 4 times more than the others. Why? Alex Tichu, who was still performing surgery on a bike, told me that here, for the first time, I feel proud of the work I do. Another one of the bike mechanics, Scott Myers, told me, it definitely feels very rewarding when you show up and see the building and don't think of it as the place where you come in to put your hours, but as the thing you've contributed to making. Sometimes, Meredith says as we look out over the floor of bikes, she feels that we're on the beginning of a cultural change. Why would anyone work in the old way, the people at Baltimore Bicycle Works wonder, when they can take back control of their work and make it meaningful again? I learned there are tens of thousands of democratic workplaces like Baltimore Bicycle Works all over the world. Several distinguished social scientists have tried to get grants to study what happens to your mental health in democratic workplaces, and they've all been turned down, so we don't have much data. But there is a large amount of evidence, as I discussed before, that feeling controlled and ordered around at work and feeling you're at the bottom of a hierarchy makes you more depressed and more anxious. It seems fair then to assume that a spread of cooperatives would have an antidepressant effect, although this is something that needs to be studied a whole lot more. I realized that this recipe for mental health could be distilled down to the three words that everyone in our culture instinctively understands. elect your boss. Work wouldn't be an ordeal that's done to you, something to endure. It'd be a democratic tribe that you are part of and that you control as much as anyone else. One of the most popular political slogans of the past few years has been take back control. People are right to connect with this slogan. They have lost control and they long to regain it. But that slogan has been used by political forces like those backing Brexit or Donald Trump that will give them even less control. This, I came to think, is a way to reclaim that slogan and help people to gain what they're rightly hungering for. Before I left her for the last time, Meredith told me that she believes this longing for meaningful work, to have a say over what you spend most of your life doing, is there just below the surface in everyone. She said, happiness is really feeling that you've impacted another human being positively. I think a lot of people want their work to be like that. And she looked around the workplace she built and controls with her colleagues. Then she looked back at me and said, you know? Chapter 19. Reconnection 4 to Meaningful Values. When I was trying to apply everything I'd learned to change in order to be less depressed, I felt a dull, insistent tug on me. I kept getting signals that the way to be happy is simple. Buy stuff. Show it off. Display your status. Acquire things. These impulses called to me from every advertisement and from so many social interactions. I had learned from Tim Kasser that these are junk values, a trap that leads only to greater anxiety and depression. But what's the way beyond them? I could understand the arguments against them very well. I was persuaded. But there they were, in my head and all around me, trying to pull me back down. But Tim, I learned, has been proposing two ways as starters to wriggle free. The first is defensive and the second is proactive, a way to stir our different values. When there's pollution in the air that makes us feel worse, we ban the source of the pollution. We don't allow factories to pump lead into our air. Advertising, he says, is a form of mental pollution. So there's an obvious solution. Restrict or ban mental pollution, just like we restrict or ban physical pollution. This isn't an abstract idea. It's already been tried in many places. For example, the city of Sao Paulo in Brazil was being slowly smothered by billboards. They covered every possible space. Gaudy logos and brands dominated the skyline wherever you looked. It made the city look ugly and made people feel ugly by telling them everywhere they looked that they had to consume. So in 2007, the city's government took a bold step. They banned all outdoor advertising, everything. They called it the Clean City Law. As the signs were removed one by one, people began to see beautiful old buildings that had long been hidden. The constant ego irritation of being told to spend was taken away and replaced with works of public art. Some 70% of the city's residents say the change has made it a better place. I went there to see it, and almost everyone says the city seems somehow psychologically cleaner and clearer than it did before. We could take this insight and go further. Several countries, including Sweden and Greece, have banned advertising directed at children. When I was writing this book, there was a controversy after a company marketing diet products put advertisements in the London Underground asking, "Are you beach body ready?" next to a picture of an impossibly lithe woman. The implication was that if you are one of the 99.99% of humans who look less buff than this, you are not ready to show your flesh on the beach. There was a big backlash and the posters were eventually banned. It prompted a wave of protests across London where people defaced ads with the words, "advertising shits in your head." It made me think, imagine if we had a tough advertising regulator who wouldn't permit ads designed to make us feel bad in any way. How many ads would survive? That's an achievable goal. And it would clear a lot of mental pollution from our minds. This has some value in itself, but I think the fight for it could spur a deeper conversation. Advertising is only the PR team for an economic system that operates by making us feel inadequate and telling us the solution is to constantly spend. If we start to really talk about how this will affect our emotional health by taking initially small steps like this, we'll start to see the scale of the bigger changes that then have to happen. There was a hint of how this might start in an experiment that tried to go deeper, not just to block bad messages that divert our desires onto junk, but to see if we can draw out our positive values. This led me to the second and most exciting path back that Tim has explored. The kids were telling Nathan Dungan one thing, over and over again. They needed stuff. They needed consumer objects. And they were frustrated, outright angry that they weren't getting them. Their parents were refusing to buy the sneakers or designer clothes or latest gadgets that they needed to have, and it was throwing them into an existential panic. Didn't their parents know how important it is to have all this? Nathan didn't expect to be having these conversations. He was a middle-aged man who'd worked in financial services in Pennsylvania for years, advising people on investments. One day he was talking to an educator at a middle school, and she explained that the kid she was working with, middle class, not rich, had a problem. They thought satisfaction and meaning came from buying objects. When their parents couldn't afford them, they seemed genuinely distressed. She asked, could Nathan come in and talk to the kids about financial realities? He agreed cautiously, but that decision was going to set him on a steep learning curve and lead him to challenge a lot of what he took for granted. Nathan went in believing his task was obvious. He was there to educate the kids and their parents about how to budget and how to live within their financial means. But then he hit this wall of need, this ravenous hunger for stuff. To him, it was baffling. Why do they want it so badly? What's the difference between the sneakers with the Nike swoosh and the sneakers without? Why would that gap be so significant that it would send kids into a panic? He began to wonder if he should be talking not about how to budget, but why the teenagers wanted these things in the first place. And it went deeper than that. There was something about seeing these teenagers craving apparently meaningless material objects that got Nathan to think, as adults, are we so different? Nathan had no idea how to start that conversation, so he began to wing it, and this led to a striking scientific experiment where he teamed up with Tim Kasser. A short time later, in a conference room in Minneapolis, Nathan met with the families who were going to be the focus of his experiment. They were a group of 60 parents and their teenage kids sitting in front of him on chairs. He was going to have a series of long sessions with them over 3 months to explore these issues and the alternatives. At the same time, the experiment followed a separate group of the same size who didn't meet with Nathan or get any other help. They were the experiment's control group. Nathan started the conversation by handing everyone worksheets with a list of open-ended questions. He explained there was no right answer, he just wanted them to start to think about these questions. One of them said, for me, money is... and you had to fill in the blank. At first, people were confused. They'd never been asked a question like this before. Lots of the participants wrote that money is scarce, or a source of stress, or something they try not to think about. They then broke into groups of eight and began to contemplate their answers, haltingly. Many of the kids had never heard their parents talk about their money worries before. Then the groups began to discuss the question, why do I spend? They began to list the reasons why they buy necessities, which are obvious, you've got to eat, and then the reasons why they buy the things that aren't necessities. Sometimes people would say they bought non-essential stuff when they felt down. Often the teenagers would say, they craved this stuff so badly because they wanted to belong. The branded clothes meant you were accepted by the group or got a sense of status. As they explored this in the conversation, it became clear quite quickly, without any prompting from Nathan, the spending often isn't about the object itself. It's about getting to a psychological state that makes you feel better. These insights were not deeply buried. People offered them quite quickly, although when they said them out loud, they seemed a little bit surprised. They knew it was just below the surface, but they'd never been asked to articulate that latent feeling before. Then Nathan asked people to list what they really value, the things they think are most important in life. Many people said it was looking after your family, or telling the truth, or helping other people. One 14-year-old boy wrote simply, love. And when he read it out, the room stopped for a moment, and you could hear a pin drop, Nathan told me. What he was speaking to was, how important is it for me to be connected? Just asking these two questions, what do you spend your money on, and what do you really value, made most people see a gap between the answers that they began to discuss. They were accumulating and spending money on things that were not, in the end, the things they believed in their heart mattered. Why would that be? Nathan had been reading up on the evidence about how we come to crave all this stuff. He learned that the average American is exposed to up to 5,000 advertising impressions a day, from billboards to logos on t-shirts to TV advertisements. It is the sea in which we swim. And, he said, the narrative is that if you buy this thing, it'll yield more happiness. And so thousands of times a day, you're just surrounded with that message. He began to ask, who's shaping that narrative? It's not people who've actually figured out what will make us happy and who are charitably spreading the good news. It's people who have one motive only, to make us buy their product. In our culture, Nathan was starting to believe, we end up on a materialistic autopilot. We're constantly bombarded with messages that we will feel better and less stinky and less disgustingly shaped and less all-round worthless only if we buy some specific product and then buy some more and buy again and on until finally your family buys your coffin. What he wondered is, if people stopped to think about this and discuss the alternatives, as his group was doing, could we turn off the autopilot and take back control for ourselves? At the next session, he asked the people in the experiment to do a short exercise in which everyone had to list a consumer item that they felt they had to have right away. They had to describe what it was, how they first heard about it, why they craved it, how they felt when they got it, and how they felt after they've had it for a while. For many people, as they talked this through, something became obvious. The pleasure was often in the craving and anticipation. We've all had the experience of finally getting the thing we want, getting it home and feeling oddly deflated, only to find out that before long, the craving cycle starts again. People began to talk about how they'd been spending, and they were slowly seeing what it was really all about. Often, not always, it was, they said, about filling a hole. It fills some sort of loneliness gap. But by pushing them towards that quick, rapidly evaporating high, it was also nudging them away from the things they really valued and that would make them feel satisfied in the long run. They felt they were becoming hollow. There were some people, both teens and adults, who rejected this fiercely. They said that the stuff made them happy and they wanted to stick with it. But most people in the group were eager to think differently. They began to talk about advertising. At first, almost everyone declared that ads might affect other people, but don't hold much sway over them. Everyone wants to be smarter than the ad, Nathan said to me later. But he guided them back to the consumer objects they had longed for. Before long, members of the group were explaining to each other, well, there's no way they're spending billions of dollars if it's not having an impact. They're just not doing that. No company's going to do that. So far, it had been about getting people to question the junk values we have been fed for so long. But then came the most important part of the experiment. Nathan explained the difference that I talked about before between extrinsic and intrinsic values. He asked people to draw up a list of their intrinsic values, the things they thought were important as an end to themselves and not because of what you get out of it. Then he asked, how would you live differently if you acted on these other values? Members of the group discussed it. They were surprised. We're constantly encouraged to talk about our extrinsic values, but the moments when we're asked to speak about our intrinsic values out loud are rare. Some said, for example, they would work less and spend more time with the people they loved. Nathan wasn't making the case for any of this. Just asking a few open questions took most of the group there spontaneously. Our intrinsic motivations are always there, Nathan realized. Lying, he said, dormant. It was just brought out into the light. Conversations like this, Nathan was realizing, don't just happen in our culture today. We don't allow space or create space for these really critical conversations to take place, so it just creates more and more isolation. Now that they'd identified how they'd been duped by junk values and identified their intrinsic values, Nathan wanted to know, could the group choose together to start following their intrinsic goals? Instead of being accountable to advertising, could they make themselves accountable to their own most important values and to a group that was trying to do the same thing? Could they consciously nurture meaningful values? Now that each person had figured out his or her own intrinsic goals, they would report back at the next series of meetings about what they'd done to start moving towards them. They held each other accountable. They now had a space in which they could think about what they really wanted in life and how to achieve it. They were talking about how they'd found a way to work less and see their kids more, for example, or how they'd taken up a musical instrument, or how they'd started to write. Nobody knew whether all this would have any real effect, though. Could these conversations really reduce people's materialism and increase their intrinsic values? Independent social scientists measured the levels of materialism of the participants at the start of the experiment and then measured them again at the end. As he waited for the results, Nathan was nervous. This was a small intervention in the middle of a lifetime of constant consumerist bombardment. Would it make any difference at all? When the results came through, both Nathan and Tim were thrilled. Tim had shown before that materialism correlates strongly with increased depression and anxiety. This experiment showed, for the first time, that it was possible to intervene in people's lives in a way that would significantly reduce their levels of materialism. The people who'd gone through this experiment had significantly lower materialism and significantly higher self-esteem. It was a big and measurable effect. It was an early shot of proof that a determined effort to reverse the values that are making us so unhappy works. The people who took part in the study could never have made these changes alone, Nathan believes. He told me there was a lot of power in that connection and that community for people, removing the isolation and the fear. There's a lot of fear around this topic. It was only together as a group that they were able to peel those layers away so you could actually get to the meaning, to the heart, their sense of purpose. I asked Nathan if we could integrate this into our ordinary lives, if we all need to form and take part in a kind of Alcoholics Anonymous for junk values, a space where we can all meet to challenge the depression-generating ideas we've been taught and learn to listen instead to our intrinsic values. I would say, without question, he said. Most of us sense we've been valuing the wrong things for too long. We need to create, he told me, a counter-rhythm to the junk values that have been making us mentally sick. From his bare conference room in Minneapolis, Nathan has proven something, that we are not imprisoned in the values that have been making us feel so lousy for so long. By coming together with other people and thinking deeply and reconnecting with what really matters, we can begin to dig a tunnel back to meaningful values. Chapter 20. Reconnection 5. Sympathetic joy and overcoming addiction to the self. I hadn't seen my friend Rachel for nearly 3 years when she walked into my hotel room in a small town in the American heartland, lay down on the bed, and laughed. When I first moved to New York, Rachel Schubert was one of the first people I bonded with. We sat next to each other when we took a class at NYU when we were both a bit disorientated by the city and by life. Rachel was in a marriage that wasn't working out for all sorts of reasons. She was trying to build a career for herself, and she was, as it turned out, about to become pregnant with her first child. I was ragged and worn from a series of crises. We bonded over several things, and one of them was bitching. She had lived in Switzerland for 2 long years. My dad is from Switzerland, and I used to be banished there for the summers as a kid, so we bitched about the Swiss. We bitched about some of the other people in the class. We bitched about our teacher. We laughed a lot. But it was often, though not always, bitter laughter, the kind that doesn't leave you feeling good. There was a lot of joy in our friendship. Her love of British comedy bonded us for life. But there was also a lot of rage when we met. After her marriage finally Hindenburged, Rachel moved back to the small town she's from in rural Illinois, and we lost touch for a while. But when I went to see her, I saw quite quickly that there had been a change in her character. She seemed lighter in spirit, and she was clearly less depressed. I asked her what happened. She told me that when she got back home, she tried taking antidepressants and had an initial bump, but then felt just as bad. Rather than jack up her dose as her doctor advised, she'd started thinking a lot about the way she approached life. She explained that after reading widely, she'd found some tools that were helping her to live differently, and for which there was some scientific evidence. Rachel had come to realize that she was angry and envious a lot of the time. She was embarrassed to say it, because she knew it made her sound bad. But, to give one example, she had a relative who'd been driving her crazy for years. She was nice, and Rachel had no reason to dislike her, but her every success in work, in her family, felt like a put-down to Rachel, and it made her dislike the relative, and that in turn made her dislike herself. This envy had spread through her life, tugging her mood down every day. It felt like a major cause of her depression and anxiety. She began to find Facebook unbearable. It felt as if everyone was flaunting their superiority, and what she came to think of as her envy monster was running wild. Over the years, she tried, alone, to find little tricks that would make her feel better. When she saw someone who had something she envied, she would think of a reason why they in fact sucked. Okay, you're gorgeous, but your husband's ugly. Okay, you have a great career, but you never see your kids. It was, she told me, her unskilled way of trying to reduce envy. This would give her relief, but only for a moment. She thought there was something wrong with her. But as she began to read about envy, she realized that our culture was priming her to feel this way. She had been raised to constantly compete and compare, she said. We're highly individualistic, she explained, and we're constantly told that life is a zero-sum game. There's only so many pieces of the pie, so if someone else has success or beauty or whatever, somehow it leaves less for you. Or if you can get it too, it's less meaningful if all these other people have it. We're trained to think that life is a fight for scarce resources, even if it's for something like intelligence, where there's no limit to how much human intelligence can grow across the world. If you become smarter, it doesn't make me less smart, but we're primed to feel that it does. So Rachel knew that if, say, she sat down and wrote a wonderful book, and at the same time, the relative she envied sat down and also wrote a wonderful book, it would, she said, almost take the wind out of my sails, even though it hasn't done anything to diminish my completely different book. We end up on a seesaw of feeling envy and then trying to make others envious. It's like we've learned so well from the advertisers, she said over the years, we're marketing experts ourselves, and now we just know how to curate and market our own lives without any conscious process. We just culturally learn it. So you display your life on Instagram and in conversations as if you are the chief marketing officer of me, not trying to get other people to buy anything other than the idea that we're awesome and worthy of envy ourselves, you know? She realized something was wrong when she heard one day through the grapevine that somebody was envious of her, and she was thrilled. I'm ashamed to tell you that, she said. Rachel didn't want to be this way. Like me, she's a strong proponent of skepticism and rationality, so she looked for techniques that scientific studies had suggested might have some basis in fact. And she discovered an ancient technique called sympathetic joy, which is part of a range of techniques for which there is some striking new scientific evidence. It is, she says, quite simple. Sympathetic joy is a method for cultivating the opposite of jealousy or envy. It's simply feeling happy for other people. Rachel guided me through how it works. You close your eyes and picture yourself. You imagine something good happening to you, falling in love, or writing something you're proud of. You feel the joy that would come from that. You let it flow through you. Then you picture somebody you love and you imagine something wonderful happening for them. You feel the joy from that and you let that too flow through you. So far, so easy. Then you picture somebody you don't really know. Say, the clerk who serves you in the grocery store. You imagine something wonderful happening to her. And you try to feel joy for her, real joy. Then it gets harder. You picture somebody you don't like, and you try to imagine something good happening for that person. And you try to feel joy for that person. You try to feel the same joy you'd feel for yourself or for somebody you love. You imagine how good they'd feel and how moved they'd be. Then you picture somebody you really dislike. Or somebody you really envy. Rachel pictured the relative she's been jealous of. And you try to feel joy for them. Real, true joy. She said, when you're meditating, you may not feel that way at all. It might actually be almost killing you to say those things. You might hate the person and their success. But you say it. You do this every day for 15 minutes. For the first few weeks, Rachel thought it felt pointless. Nothing changed. But then she started to notice. Over time, she said, I don't feel that same churning punch in the gut. It's just not there. She felt the toxic feeling slowly abate. envy wasn't puncturing her several times a day in the same way. The longer she did it, the more these feelings ebbed. Thinking about the relative she had a particular problem with, she says, "It doesn't mean that I don't feel envy at all about her ever again. It just means that it's been taken down so many notches that I don't experience the same pain." This kind of meditation is about, she says, setting the intention to feel different, almost like saying, "I want to feel differently about you," and saying it enough times until you really do. I think it works on you below the level of ordinary consciousness. As she kept on practicing, she started to notice something more. Part of the point of sympathetic joy meditation is that you feel less envy, but an even more important part is that you start to see the happiness of others not as a rebuke, but as a source of joy for yourself too. One day, Rachel was in a park, and she saw a bride in her wedding dress with her groom posing for pictures. Before, she would have felt envy and comforted herself by finding some flaw in the bride or groom. This time, she felt a rush of joy, and it really lifted her for the rest of the day. She didn't feel that the bride's happiness took away from her happiness. She felt it added to it. She didn't start mentally comparing this bride to how she looked on her own wedding day. She would never see this couple again. But her eyes welled up with sympathetic joy. I asked her what it feels like. She said, "It's happiness. It's warmth. And it has a tender quality to it. It's almost like people become your children. That same tender, warm happiness you have for your child when they're having fun and they're happy or they get something they like. You can feel that for a complete stranger. And it's quite incredible. It's almost like looking at them through the eyes of a loving parent that just wants someone they love to be happy and have good things. And there's a tenderness to it for me." She was surprised that she could change in this way. "You think that certain things aren't malleable," she says, "but they completely are. You can be a total jealous monster, and you think that's just part of who you are, and you find you can change it by just doing some basic thing." As Rachel and I spent a few days together, wandering around, eating in diners, I could see a real change in her, and I could see the irony right away. I started to envy it. Rachel looked at me and said, "I've pursued happiness for myself my whole life, and I'm exhausted, and I don't feel any closer to it. Because where does it end? The bar just keeps getting moved." But this different way of thinking, she said, seemed to offer a real sense of pleasure and a path away from the depressing, anxiety-provoking thoughts she's been plagued by. "There's always going to be shit coming into your life to be unhappy about," she said. "If you can be happy for others, there's always going to be a supply of happiness available to you. Vicarious joy is going to be available millions of ways every single day. If you want to look at other people and be happy for them, you can be happy every single day, regardless of what's happening to you." As she began to practice this, she realized it was really a radical break with what she'd been taught. She's conscious that to many people, this would sound like a philosophy for losers. You can't make it, so you have to get a thrill when somebody else does. You'll lose your edge. You'll fall behind in the constant race for success. But Rachel thinks this is a false dichotomy. Why can't you be happy for other people and for yourself? Why would being eaten with envy make you stronger? She felt she was slowly realizing that the things she'd been trained by the culture to envy were in fact the least valuable things we have. She said, "Who's envious of somebody else's good character? Who's envious of somebody else's wonderful treatment of their spouse? You're not envious of that. You might admire it. You're not envious of it. You're envious of other shit. You're envious of what people have materially or status-wise." As the meditation progressed across the years, Rachel began to see that even if she got those things, they wouldn't make her happy. They're not what matters. "I think this concept could help tons of people with depression," Rachel said, pointing me to the scientific evidence, which I then studied in detail. The largest scientific study of using meditation as a treatment for depression found something really interesting. It turned out that depressed people were significantly more likely to recover from depression if they went into an 8-week meditation training program than people in a control group who didn't. Some 58% of the control group became depressed again, while only 38% of the newly trained meditators did, a huge gap. Other studies have found that meditation is similarly helpful for people with anxiety. One different study honed this effect a little and found that meditation works particularly well for people who've developed depression as a result of abusive childhoods. They have a 10% higher improvement rate than others. But I was especially keen to read the scientific evidence about the particular style of meditation Rachel had been teaching me to find out whether it actually changes people. If you took part in the major study that's been conducted into a technique like this, you were randomly assigned to one of two groups. One group did loving kindness meditation and the other got no help. If you were in the first group, you did a style of meditation similar to Rachel's every day for a few weeks. Then at the end, both groups were tested. The test took a particular form. You took part in games, which you were told were a warm-up. You didn't know that some of the people taking part were in fact actors. During the games, subtly and unexpectedly, one of them would drop something or clearly need help in some other way. What the researchers wanted to find out was, would there be any difference between the people who'd been practicing this technique and the people who hadn't when it came to offering help? It turned out, if you'd done the loving-kindness meditation, you were almost twice as likely to help somebody else than the people who hadn't. This is an early sign suggesting Rachel was right. You could double your compassion through doing this practice, even for a short time, and that in turn would lead to greater connection to other people. It's as though the loving kindness meditation works a muscle that helps us resist and counteract the worst of our culture. It's not so much what happens in those 15 minutes. Rachel has come to feel, she said, that you're planting seeds during the meditation, and it flowers spontaneously during your day and your life. All through this book, I've been talking about how the evidence shows there are three different kinds of causes of depression: biological, psychological, and social. Right at the start, I talked about how the biological interventions we currently have, antidepressants, don't do much for most of us. Then, up to now, I've been talking about the environmental or social changes that might be able to help us. But what Rachel was teaching me was something quite different. She was proposing a psychological change. There are other kinds of psychological changes people can try too. One is prayer. There's evidence that people who pray become less depressed. I'm an atheist, so that's not on the table for me. Another is cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which encourages people to train themselves out of negative patterns or thoughts and to move to more positive ones. The evidence suggests that this kind of therapy has a small effect and it doesn't last very long, but its effect is real nonetheless. To be fair, the main champion of CBT, Professor Richard Layard, says it should be combined with social change if you want the best results. And another is psychotherapy. It's hard to scientifically measure whether that helps you. You can't set up a clinical trial in which you give someone fake therapy and compare it to real therapy. But there is some striking evidence about the value of therapy for people who've had a traumatic childhood, which I'll come to in the next chapter. So it's worth underscoring, it's not only environmental change that can help people. Even if you really believe you're trapped and you genuinely can't change your environment, some of these methods might help. And my strong suspicion is that if they do help you to ease your depression and anxiety, you will realize you can change your environment by banding together with other people more than you think. Until I had this experience with Rachel, I'd been wary about meditation. And there were, I realized, two reasons. The first is that I was afraid of being still and alone with my thoughts. I associated that with depression and anxiety. The second is that I found many of the reasons why meditation has been promoted over the past few years to be problematic. There are self-help gurus who've made a fortune telling people that meditation can make you a better little worker bee, more able to cope with working constantly and being loaded with stress. This seemed to me to be just another individualistic solution that misses the point. Why do so many people feel overloaded and stressed out in the first place, and how do we stop it happening? But I now knew there were lots of different kinds of meditation. Rachel's school of meditation is the opposite of this individualistic meditation that disturbed me. It's not about dealing with the distress and strain of disconnection a little better. It's about finding a way back to reconnection. The thing that most fascinated me about Rachel's transformation was the way she talked about changing her relationship with her own ego. She didn't seem rattled by the constant ego jabbing that assaults us all the time in our culture. From advertising, from social media, from competitive people all around her, she'd found a way to protect herself from it. Once I saw this, I asked myself, what more could we do to protect ourselves from the depressants that are polluting our atmosphere? What else could we do to shrink our egos and strengthen our connections? As I read more about the science of meditation, I started to delve into a different but related series of studies that, frankly, I was pretty skeptical of at first. If you've read my previous book, Chasing the Scream, you'll know that I referred to some aspects of this quite dismissively. And yet I kept looking at the latest scientific results, and they were startling. So I went on a journey into this field. What I learned might sound weird to you at first. It sounded weird to me. But stick with me. Roland Griffith was trying to meditate, but he couldn't do it. If he sat there for a few minutes, it would feel like hours, stretching out agonizingly before him. All he felt at the end of it was frustration, so he gave up. He would not meditate again for 20 years, when it became part of unlocking something crucial not just for himself, but for all of us. He'd been a young grad student when his attempts at meditation had flickered out, and Roland was at the start of a stellar career in academic psychology. He rose through this field to become a leading professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Maryland, one of the best academic institutions in the world. When I met him, he was one of the most respected figures internationally when it came to the study of drug use, especially the effects of caffeine. As we sat in his office, he explained to me that after 20 years of rising to this position, if I hadn't been certifiably workaholic, I was pretty close to it. My career had gone well, he said, but he felt something was lacking. I felt as though in some respects I was going through the motions of being a scientist and having a career in science. He realized he was starting to think again, he didn't quite know why, about the flailing attempts at meditation he'd made all those years before. It was heresy in his field to think about the deep inner self. He was a specialist in a field of psychology that regarded all this as hippie-ish nonsense and not something serious academic psychologists should think about at all. But, he said, it seemed quite apparent to me there was something fascinating about this methodology of meditation that had been focused for thousands of years on trying to plumb the depths of these deeper experiences of mind, self, consciousness, whatever that means. He had a friend who went regularly to an ashram, a spiritual retreat, in upstate New York to meditate as part of a group. And one day, Roland asked to go along. Unlike his attempts all those years before, he had somebody there to guide him in his meditation and to talk him through how to do it. This time, he found he could meditate after all. As he kept doing it, day after day, he found to his surprise, this inner world started to open up, and I started to open up, he said. That became, frankly, enthralling to me. The people he was meeting, who'd been meditating for years, seemed to have a spiritual dimension to their lives that really benefited them in all sorts of ways. They appeared calmer and happier and less anxious. Roland started to feel there were dimensions to his own character and to everyone's character that he had neglected in his own life and that weren't being properly studied by academics. So he started to ask himself some basic questions. What is happening when a person meditates? What changes in them? If you meditate in a dedicated way, for long enough, most people, like my friend Rachel, say that they start to experience a spiritual change. They value things differently. They see the world differently. Why, Roland wanted to know, would that be? Why did meditation make people feel they were being changed in a way that was mystical? And what did that even mean? He started to look for scientific studies that might have investigated people who feel they are having mystical experiences. And he discovered there was quite a large literature on it, although it was rather peculiar. From the mid-1950s to the late 1960s, different groups of scientists working at top universities across the United States had discovered something. They found that if you give people psychedelic drugs, mostly LSD, which was legal at the time, under clinical conditions, you can fairly predictably cause them to have what feel like spiritual experiences. You can make them feel they're transcending their egos and their everyday concerns and connecting intensely with something much deeper, with other people, with nature, even with the nature of existence itself. The vast majority of people given the drug by doctors said that it made them feel this way and that the experience seemed profound to them. As he read through this, Roland noticed one thing in particular. The way people described feeling when they took psychedelics was strikingly similar to the way people said they felt if they had a deep, sustained program of meditation. When all this research had been taking place, the scientists seemed to be discovering all sorts of benefits to giving people these drugs under clinical conditions. When it was given to chronic alcoholics, a startling number stopped drinking. When it was given to chronically depressed people, many of them felt radically better and left behind their depression. These scientific trials were not conducted according to the standards that we use today, and the results should be viewed with some caution, but they caught Roland's eye. Yet across the United States, toward the end of the 60s, there was a panic about psychedelics. Some people had had bad experiences taking these drugs recreationally, and on top of that, there were lots of stories that were invented to demonize the drugs. For example, claims that if you took LSD, you could stare into the sun and go blind. In the midst of this controversy, LSD was banned. All scientific research on psychedelics was abruptly stopped, and the trail went cold. Looking at these studies afresh in the 1990s, Roland was